With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny.
This week, Anne Yu on her debut novel, Braised Pork.
Anne Yu was born in 1992 and raised in Beijing, where she became interested in capturing the stories of modern life in the city. She has since studied and worked in New York and Paris and writes her fiction in English. And Braised Pork, which is her first novel we're going to be talking about today. Anne, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you.
Tell me, first of all, how you would describe this novel.
Oh, it's a novel at its core sort of about a woman's journey to overcoming loss and making amends with her past, and also making more sense of her own identity as, you know, as a recently widowed woman, as well as a human being within the context of Beijing.
And this is your debut novel, so yeah. Can we talk for a bit about how it actually came about, over what period of time it was written?
So I wrote this, I started in 2016, and it took about 2 years to just get a final draft done. And it started off as, you know, an idea for a story. And then I wrote sort of short stories out of the main character, Jia Jia. And then I had a dream of the fish man, which is, you know, a recurring motif in the novel. And I wanted to combine the two somehow and try to experiment with a story, you know, birthed out of these two ideas, and quickly realized that it was going to be, you know, a much longer piece. And that's sort of how I started writing. And just, you know, it kept going, and it became a story that I sort of never really planned to write the way it turned out. The first half sort of went according to plan, and the second just sort of wrote itself eventually, I think.
Our protagonist then, yeah. Wu Jia Jia, it's not. It's a story that's told in the third person, so mm-hmm. it's not her narrative, but she is definitely our main mm-hmm. protagonist. There's a number of other really great characters in the story, but tell us first of all who she is.
So she is in her early 30s, and she used to be an artist, and then she got married to a wealthier sort of businessman, Chen Hang. So he dies rather mysteriously at the beginning of the novel, and starting then, she sort of embarks on this journey towards finding out more about his death and about herself. And in the constraints of her marriage, she was sort of not allowed to pursue her art anymore, and it became more of a hobby kind of thing. So we also, throughout the novel, see her reconnect with her artistic pursuits.
Tell me more about her late husband then as well, because I mean, I guess most of all I want to know really, you know, some more about their marriage, you know, what their marriage was like before he mysteriously dies. As you've just sort of, you know, explained, she's quite constrained within this marriage, and I wonder what was in it for him. Tell me something about this, mm-hmm. the dynamics of this marriage.
So it was contractual from both ends. They both saw something important in the marriage that wasn't purely emotional. So for her, it was sort of financial stability and I suppose overall stability. And she sort of believed that if rationally a marriage made sense, it would last. And for him, he, you know, is an older man and he's quite wealthy. And he, even with all sort of his wealth, he still has, you know, his insecurities. And he thinks that having an elegant and very sort of well-behaved woman as his wife would add to his, I suppose, image as a whole.
On his death, she is, I guess, both adrift. You know, she's living in this much too big apartment mm-hmm. that, you know, becomes more and more empty. But at the same time, obviously, she is set free
right.
From the constraints of that marriage. And I wanted to talk about a bit about the sort of the contrast between those. You know, a lot of the remaining story of the plot of the novel is her basically, you know, coming to terms mm-hmm. with those two competing ideas.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think when she's sort of thrown into the situation, she has no clue how to navigate it. She doesn't know whether she should just sort of go on as, you know, this recently widowed woman and live her life the same way she had been before. And then she quickly realizes that she can't. And in her sort of misery at the same time, in her lost and wandering state, she becomes more aware of what had happened, like, in her past. So her past sort of comes and she's been, like, waylaid by it in a way. And I think as she moves on, she becomes more clear about her simultaneous sort of grief and anger and resentment, and on the other hand, her, like, newly found freedom and hope. And it's, I suppose, like, the whole surreal part as well of the novel is supposed to underscore that and complement that feeling of, you know, these two tensions coexisting.
Yeah, the very sort of the metaphor of her, which we'll talk about later in the interview, but there's this, you know, ongoing metaphor of a sea, of her drowning, not being able to breathe, right. Which obviously sort of like feeds into that sort of feeling of being cut adrift in the way that she is. I don't want to go too deeply into her past because, again, it forms the sort of, you know, right. the core of the story, which we don't want to give too much away. But I don't want to talk about her mother, but she has an estranged father. Can we just mm-hmm. talk for a moment about the relationship she has with her father?
Yeah. So her father, from her point of view, her father sort of left her mother and her when she was very young. And ever since then, she hadn't had a very sort of close relationship with her father, and they would sort of meet up once every year over a very casual lunch where he didn't seem like he cared that much about her, and she resented him for it. So that is sort of her impression of her father at the beginning of the novel, and that will slowly shift as the novel goes on.
And she's been raised by a grandmother mm-hmm. and an aunt. Mm-hmm. Tell us something about these two characters. Yeah.
So I personally really, really sort of love those two characters because they sort of both exist within this tiny little apartment that Jia Jia's grandmother owned from, you know, when she was much younger. And it's this apartment where, so her grandmother lives there, her aunt and her aunt's newlywed husband. So they're all sort of in this tiny little apartment. And then Jia Jia eventually moved there too. So she grew up around this old lady who, you know, is very tough and has, you know, her own opinions on how Jia Jia should live her life. And then her aunt is this sort of carefree, romantic woman who, you know, just wants Jia Jia to sort of be happy. But, of course, at the same time, her aunt projects her own sort of thoughts onto Jia Jia as well, thinking that, you know, she keeps telling Jia Jia, like, you should do this, you should do that.
She has all these sort of crazy schemes.
Yes, she does.
Get-rich schemes.
Yeah. And she wants Jia Jia to follow some of her advice, which a lot of times weren't very clever. And once she moved out of all of that, she's been rather sort of alone since then, I think. But even growing up within this household of, you know, there's clearly love coming from both her aunt and her grandmother, the missing sort of parent, the missing mother, the missing father sort of still added to her loneliness since childhood all the way up until, you know, the book.
And there's an incident that happens, I mean, I guess probably about a third of the way into the book, where mm-hmm. her aunt's husband gets caught up in a sort of like government anti-corruption mm-hmm. sweep. And at that point, when that happened, I realised that actually this is one of the first times where sort of the real world had sort of intruded into the story. The story is set, you know, Zhao Zhao's grown up and is living in sort of modern day Beijing. Mm-hmm. But so far, what we've seen is a sort of, you know, bland internationalist city of apartment buildings mm-hmm. and not really anything of, you know, what one might imagine mm-hmm. of Beijing. And that is not the case when we go on later, which we'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. When we go on to, you know, to visit Tibet in the yeah. book. And obviously a large part of the story is going to be sort of, you know, bringing in sort of folk tales mm-hmm. into the story. But as I said, I just sort of realised that, you know, actually we weren't getting much of mm-hmm. what I would imagine Beijing as a city to be. And I wondered if that was obviously a deliberate
yeah.
thing.
So in a sense, I think living, just honestly speaking, living in Beijing, you don't really... You're not constantly being aware that, you know, this is China, this is Beijing I'm living in. It feels like, you know, a lot of other big cities around the world with its, like you said, apartment buildings, office buildings, bars, restaurants. But of course, there are moments where, you know, things happen that are more specifically to the location and the setting. And I wanted that to be how the setting felt in the book. I wanted to just, you know, organically come in and not become, you know, a statement and a thing being, you know, like, this book is set in Beijing and here, let me tell you why. So I wanted it to be more organic.
When we go into the second part of the interview, I want to talk in the main about the, you know, the folk aspects yeah. and the more surreal aspects of the story. And to get us there, another point where I guess the, you know, the real world intrudes. Zhao Zhao embarks on this sort of, you know, relationship with a bartender, Leo, and at one point he takes her to visit his parents mm-hmm. for New Year. Mm-hmm. And what transpires out of this is that, you know, they consider widows to be bad luck. Yeah. And indeed, as you mentioned, Zhao Zhao's already been sort of abandoned by her parents-in-law mm-hmm. for similar reasons. And I just wanted to talk about this idea, this sort of idea of, you know, these old sort of traditions, old superstitions from a couple of generations back. Yeah. Seeping into the modern day.
Yes, I think that even though just people of not only sort of the young generation, but also the one before that and the one before that, everyone, I think a lot of people have the intention to, you know, adopt more sort of modern philosophies and not to be so superstitious, especially in large cities like Beijing and Shanghai. But at the same time, it's hard to let go of that when it comes to when it becomes too personal, when it becomes about your son marrying a woman. So there's that sort of tension, and Leo had never really thought about Jia Jia that way at all. And of course, Jia Jia has insecurities when it comes to that as well, which is sort of what led into their kind of argument in the car after that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Anne Yu, and we're talking about her debut novel, Braised Pork. And Anne, as I mentioned, I want to go on to talk about the central image of this novel, which is when Jar Jar finds her dead husband, he has left behind this mysterious drawing, basically of a sort of, I'd like to say a merman, like a half man, half fish, a fish with a man's head. Yeah. Which she becomes obsessed with and wants to get to the bottom of of what this means. Tell me where that image comes from.
So that image came from a dream I had, but soon it became more than just a striking image to me. I think soon it became much more, I don't want to say symbolic because I don't exactly know what it symbolizes, but it becomes much more something much more important and substantial to the novel as sort of a guide between the real and the surreal, and the fish man becomes something really crucial to all the characters involved in their journey into and out of and perhaps into forever the world of water.
So this is not a symbol that's a famous story from Chinese or Tibetan folklore.
No,
then.
I don't think so. Ever since then, I've been seeing sort of pictures around. I was in a museum, I think in Paris, a year ago, and I just saw a painting of, you know, the fish man, and then I keep seeing it everywhere now. So it must not be, you know, all that original as I thought. But no, it didn't. I wasn't particularly inspired by a specific folklore when I thought of the image.
Well, that's interesting then, because that means you've had to develop this mythology for yourself. So let's talk about that, you know, sort of how you went about creating what seems like to me a something that's plucked straight out of some sort of mythology.
So I've had the world of water as an image running through my head for a while, and I didn't really know, I didn't want to touch it for a long time, and I didn't really, because I didn't really know under what context I should bring it in. But in Jia Jia's sort of wandering state, it became something that feels almost inevitable and obvious for her to experience. And it encapsulates this, I think, like nocturnal strangeness of her world, which is, you know, filled with empty apartments, small bars at night, a lot of hazed, not only literal haze in the air, but also just this dreamy state she's in. And it became something quite central and essential to her journey. And since her past sort of violently comes into her present, it made a lot of sense for the world of water to have influenced her past as well as her parents. And it seemed like a place where she would go into to experience the strangeness and the completely sort of blackness at the same time, hope, somewhere with hope and freedom and whatever. It just seemed like a place where she would naturally go into, and also seemed like a place where other people would go into as well and would want to explore.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just without giving too much away about the actual sort of meaning, let's just elaborate for us on what you mean by the world of water. So at numerous points in the book, she is, I don't know, like, you know, imagines or is transported into this other state where literally at one point she's just in this black sea, a sort of nothingness, but that is, you know, feels like a sea. At another point, she's been hired to paint this painting of Buddha on the wall for a rich couple, and all of the blues in that painting just sort of dissolve into water. And this obviously feels, I mean, I'm saying it feels real to her, as if, you know, this is some sort of mental state. But of course, you know, there's also allusions that it could be some sort of, like, you know, I guess parallel reality or something.
Right. Well, the way I see it is that I don't see a very distinct boundary between what is the real world and what is the world of water, what is the more surreal. I think it's, I find that in my experience, there are moments where, you know, a small thing, a small object or a conversation or a word could transport you and your experience into a different realm, and where everything suddenly seems strange, and it might just come back immediately, or you might get stuck in that sort of mind space where, you know, everything around you just seems like, what is going, everything is eerie and strange. And the world of water, for me, is that space, in a very sort of vague sense of whatever it means. So it could, this constant sort of shift between, you know, reality and irreality is not only like a running theme in the book, but also I think real life is often sort of like that. Yeah.
And there are numerous characters throughout the book that have some sort of connection to the world of water that aren't necessarily that apparently connected. So I guess it also seems a metaphor for, I said, that some sort of, you know, mental state, depression perhaps, or certainly at least is something that happens when people are going through some sort of stress. There are disappearances often linked, or deaths often linked to its appearance.
Yeah, I don't... it could be depression. It could be something more nuanced and contradictory than depression. For some of the characters, it is a place where they feel like they have to go, where they feel like it's an escape, or sort of the only escape from the reality that they've been living. For some characters, it feels more real than the real world. For some characters, it's sort of a dream that, or it's a place that they want to go, but they might not have been able to access at all. So I think for different characters, it will manifest in different ways.
I also like the way that in this, you know, it was an elusive... The book often seems to set off in sort of a direction. So, for instance, when she goes to Tibet to search, where she is convinced she is going to find the answers. And, I mean, I guess, you know, in a way she does, but in the more obvious way, she's going there looking for this particular carving, this particular statue, which, you know, turns out to be not what she's expecting. I like the way that sort of idea of, you know, following in different directions, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, sort of fed through the book.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, sometimes you go on a journey with a very obvious goal in mind, and then it's very soon it sort of turns into something completely different, and you're okay with that. For her, it's not only the physical journey, but an emotional, psychological journey, and I think for many people too, it's... you never really end up where you sort of wanted to be, but, and that's okay, and that might even be better.
Can we talk a bit about that trip to Tibet? Because, as I sort of alluded to earlier, when in that section, it suddenly, the book becomes much more descriptive, you know, often much more lyrical about the environment as she is journeying back to, you know, basically a village from the past. And there's definitely a sort of change in the register. Tell me about that.
Well, to Jia Jia, it's also going to a foreign sort of alien land. So the reader, I think we are experiencing it the same way she is, where we're noticing things that she's not used to, or that she notices, whether it's, you know, the strange village and the strange people in there, or mountains that she's never really seen before. Whereas in Beijing, it was, you know, where she was born and raised, everything she notices is an extension of how she's feeling at the time. It's more like the same building she's been seeing for 20 years suddenly means something different. Whereas in Tibet, it's all new. So I suppose that's mostly what contributes to the change in tone in the narrative.
And then finally, before, just to, you know, to follow on from that, mm-hmm. before I get you to read a bit of the book, if you would, I was going to raise the title. And again, I don't know how much we can talk about it without giving too much away. Mm-hmm. But in the same way, it's something that becomes, that takes on, it's a while before it becomes apparent why the book is called Braised Pork. And then, you know, that menu item takes on a sort of real symbolic meaning as well.
I don't know if I'd describe it as being symbolic. It's more just, it's important, I think.
Yeah.
It's very important for her, and it doesn't really mean that much. There's no grander meaning behind it, but nonetheless, very significant to her entire journey.
Can I get you to read a bit?
Of course. I'll read from the beginning. Braised Pork. The orange scarf slid from Jia Jia's shoulder and dropped into the bath. It sank and turned darker in color, hovering by Chen Hang's head like a goldfish. A few minutes earlier, Jia Jia had walked into the bathroom, a scarf draped on each shoulder, to ask for her husband's preference. Instead, she had found him crouching, face down in the half-filled tub, his rump sticking out from the water. "Oh, lovely, are you trying to wash your hair?" was what she had asked him. She knew well that he would not pull such a joke on her, but was it even possible for a grown man to drown in this tub? She checked his wrist for a pulse and bent to see whether there were bubbles coming out of his nose. She called his name, stepped into the bath and grabbed him by the torso to lift him, so that at least he could be the right way up. But he refused to budge, rigid like a broken robot. The ambulance was on its way, or so they said. Jia Jia sank to her knees on the beige-tiled floor. She pulled the plug so the water could drain. It was the only thing she could think of doing now. Maybe, without the water, Chen Hang would be able to breathe again. Crossing her arms on the rim of the bath, Jia Jia observed her husband's body as if he were a sculpture in the museum. She had never seen such stillness. She was certain that this was the first moment of silence she had spent with him in their 4 years of marriage. Even when they slept, there were always sounds. His snoring, the air conditioning, cars on the street. But she could not hear anything now. His crouching body appeared to be growing grayer and thinner, like dried and unglazed clay that was going to fall apart. Jia Jia felt suddenly like vomiting, realizing that she had not been breathing either. She covered her mouth with her palm and tried to think about something else. She thought about how long it took for a body to grow cold after death. A few minutes? An hour? A few hours? She did not know. The humidity pressed down like hands on her throat, and the marble bathroom that had always been far too large seemed too small in this moment, suffocating for the two of them. It became clear to Jia Jia that Chen Hang must not have considered, not even for a moment, that such a place was improper for a death. He had not thought about his wife, who was going to be the first to find him, who was going to be alone when she did, and who would certainly be forced to wait before anyone else would join her in that bathroom. He had not pictured her in those few minutes after discovering him there, naked and dead, because if he had, he would have surely chosen another way. During their breakfast that morning, Chen Hang had muttered, with a sigh and a mouthful of pickled cucumber, that perhaps it would be a good idea to resume their annual trip to Sanya. This was the first time anything encouraging had come out of his mouth for weeks. He had called off their holiday the previous year for unspecified reasons. Presentiments Jia Jia had feared of his increasing lack of interest in her and their marriage. He had never loved her, no, she knew that much. She was not a fool. But they had promised each other a lifelong partnership, held together if not by love, then by their declared intention to have a family. And so as long as he had assured her that he intended to remain married to her, everything else had been forgivable. "When will we go?" Jia Jia had responded immediately, Chen Hang still chewing on that cucumber. "I'll start packing after breakfast." "Whenever you like, I'm going to have a bath." "A bath?" Chen Hang knew Jia Jia knew that Chen Hang had never been a man to have baths. He found no pleasure in soaking himself in hot water and preferred to shower, believing it led to cleaner results. She wanted to inquire further. She quickly swallowed her food, drank some water, and opened her mouth to speak, but decided to keep her silence for fear of irritating him with her questions and forcing him into a bad mood so early in the day. "Don't pack too much," he warned her, bringing the bowl of congee to his mouth and eating what was left in one gulp. Jia Jia heard him put in the plug and start the water. It was November and she had just finished organizing their wardrobes for winter. She opened his suitcase, mounted the chair, and reached into the upper compartment of the wardrobe for his summer clothes, refusing to let herself be distracted for fear of forgetting something of his. She was not going to let that ruin their trip. Let him have his bath, she decided. Let him have his time alone.
So I've been talking to Anne Yu. We've been talking about her debut novel, Braised Pork, which is out now in the UK from Harville Secker. And thank you so much for taking the time to share it with me.
Thank you for having me.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders that we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.